Thanks so much for downloading this podcast from the Farenco's Safeguarding Unit. My name is Verian Exelby. I'm a senior lawyer in the Safeguarding Unit, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Sophia Coles.
Hello, thank you for joining us. I'm also a lawyer in the Safeguarding Unit, and today we're going to be talking about safeguarding in the context of the UK's response to the Ukrainian crisis. So we all know Russia's invasion of Ukraine, now approaching its sixth awful week, has prompted an outpouring of anger, horror, and compassion around the world. And we've watched the conflict destroy places we associate with safety, security, community, so schools, hospitals, neighborhoods, and many Ukrainians are understandably fleeing the conflict in search of safety for themselves and their families. And this has resulted in an overwhelming response from people wanting to open their homes to those seeking refuge. And events like this war can often leave us feeling totally hopeless and helpless. And this wish to welcome and house people, I've seen as being a wonderful expression of solidarity and proactivity, and really bringing a sense of being able to do something in the face of something so catastrophic.
Unprecedented numbers of refugees are pouring into Europe at the moment. I think there's been about 4 million in 5 weeks. And obviously with this comes huge risks of all sorts of things relating to safeguarding, but trafficking and losing track of individuals. And there's this level of chaos that calls for immediate measures. And we at the Safeguarding Unit talked about this in our last monthly meeting and reflected on what we could do in particular about the dangers and risks faced by children, young people, and those vulnerable adults who are being impacted. And we discussed what we could do to discuss the practicalities of hosting incoming families and thinking about what we as safeguarding experts could provide in terms of information and support to those involved. So the Homes for Ukraine Community Sponsorship Programme, which was announced in Parliament on the 14th of March this year. And it's also being led with the support of the charity Reset. It's got ambitious targets of placing thousands of individuals with hosts here in the UK. Needless to say, this is a far from straightforward operation. And there'll be so many challenges in ensuring that the programme is run effectively and safely for everyone. In such a fast-paced situation where urgency and necessity are the driving forces, it's of course an enormous challenge to ensure that the response is thoughtful, properly informed around risk, and that all adequate procedures and processes are put in place to protect everyone.
So with that in mind, Verian and I have two fantastic guests with us today who between them have a wealth of technical and practical knowledge around displacement, asylum, refugee rights, and the frameworks and practical realities for people leaving conflict zones and arriving in places like the UK.
I'd first like to welcome Sheila Reynolds, and she's the head of asylum advocacy at the charity Freedom from Torture. Prior to this current job, she worked at UNHCR and Refugee Action. Freedom from Torture provides specialist support to help asylum seekers and refugees who have survived torture to recover and rebuild their lives.
And our second guest is Rebecca Novell, and she is the Refugee Resettlement and Asylum Dispersal Operations and Contract Manager at Lancashire County Council. And she started her career as a social worker, and Rebecca worked with young offenders in London before moving to Lancashire, where she joined Lancaster City Council and has since then focused her energies on working with asylum seekers and refugees in various capacities before taking on this current role. So we are both delighted to have both Sheila and Rebecca with us today.
So firstly, if I can turn to you, Sheila, before we get into the substance of our conversation, I think it's really helpful if we could hear a bit more about what you do as head of asylum advocacy and how your day-to-day work has been impacted by what's been happening in Ukraine in recent weeks.
Yeah, hi Sophia, hi Verian. Thanks for inviting me on. So Freedom from Torture, you've explained already, we provide expert therapeutic rehabilitation services, as well as legal and welfare support to torture survivors across England and in Glasgow. We have a centre in Glasgow as well. Now, most torture survivors in the UK are either seeking asylum or have been recognised as refugees. So I head up our asylum advocacy team, and what my team does is we gather evidence from across our clinical services and our legal services to try and better understand the experiences that torture survivors have of the asylum system. And we try and come up with policy proposals to make that system a bit better. We also work really closely with our campaigns colleagues to inform the public debate around asylum and to try and build a movement calling for a fairer and more compassionate asylum system in the UK. Yeah, how has Ukraine changed our day-to-day work? I would say Ukraine has dramatically changed the picture for us. I mean, it's the fastest growing refugee crisis in Europe since the Second World War. And you've talked about the numbers already. You mentioned, you know, 4 million people have left Ukraine. There's another 6.5 million people, I think, displaced within the country. And, you know, what's been kind of equally astonishing from our point of view has been the outpouring of public compassion for Ukrainian refugees. You know, we've never seen anything like it, I don't think. 200,000 people have signed up to offer their homes through the Homes to Ukraine scheme. That's incredible. So, you know, we are clearly a welcoming and compassionate people. But I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that all of this is happening against the backdrop of a government that's actively trying through the Nationality and Borders Bill to shut down access to protection in this country. So that's where my team are focusing our efforts on explaining to the public and to decision makers that if you want the UK to be a country that welcomes refugees like Ukrainians and others, then we really must resist the legislation that's going through Parliament right now.
Wow, that sounds like it's had a significant impact on the work you're doing, and obviously presents a huge sort of opportunity for you to sort of leverage this focus to really make some positive changes. And I think turning to you, Rebecca, it'd be interesting to hear also from your perspective what these events in Ukraine have meant for your work.
Yeah, well, previously local authorities were still kind of firefighting the Afghan evacuation, so that was taking up most of our time, and we of course have the ongoing UK resettlement scheme as well, but this has effectively blown all that out of the water. And whilst we are still continuing to facilitate those resettlement schemes, as well as kind of coordinate the response to asylum dispersal, which we see a large number of in our county, it has become a kind of 24-hour job, simply because some of the legislation, some of the guidance isn't there, and we have a lot of questions and concerns, and we're kind of having to put in processes and protocols based on very little. So based on best practice, but certainly not with centralized guidance, and that's quite challenging. The other thing is it impacts almost all levels of local authority, from housing to education to public health, and we just simply don't have the resources to deal with an uncapped number. So previously with resettlement, we'd say, okay, we'll take 600 Syrians, 800 Afghans, and we can plan accordingly and we can choose the area. But as this is uncapped and we don't choose the area, it's making it extremely challenging.
Thanks so much, Rebecca and Sheila, for explaining that. And Sheila, you just talked about the outpouring from the UK of, you know, everyday people just wanting to do what they can to help, feeling genuinely shocked and horrified at the images that we see of these desperate people trying to make their way to the UK or somewhere else in search of, well, peace, but also a home, a new home. And it is fantastic, as you said, that everyone is wanting to do their bit. From a legal perspective, what is the status of those people? What rights do they have, you know, whether in the UK or elsewhere in Europe?
Yeah, it's quite complicated, and a bit like Rebecca was saying, you know, it's a constantly moving, constantly changing feast, if that's the right analogy. Yeah, I mean, these are people in very desperate situations. I think, you know, we've had more recent news about possible war crimes that have been going on in Ukraine, including torture and sexual violence by Russian troops retreating from Kyiv, which I think just kind of further illustrates the suffering that many of these people have endured and the kind of the levels of trauma that they're likely to be experiencing and carrying with them. Yeah, I mean, huge numbers. We've talked about already that, you know, 4 million people have crossed the border from Ukraine, and most of them have gone to neighboring countries. So the vast majority are in Poland, Romania, Moldova. And that puts a phenomenal amount of pressure on the infrastructure in those countries. So people have understandably moved on and moved across Europe. And about a month ago, the European Council activated the Temporary Protection Directive, which then obliges EU member states to give Ukrainians the right to stay for up to 3 years. And that includes other rights like right to work, access, education, housing, healthcare, things like that. So this approach that the EU's taken, that it allows for a very quick kind of emergency response. It basically provides a group-based protection status following, you know, what is effectively a mass influx of refugees, where it would, under other circumstances, it would be impossible to process every individual claim for protection. So this approach takes the pressure off any national asylum processing system, which would basically collapse under the kind of numbers that we're looking at. But it also, really importantly, it reduces the likelihood of onward movement, because the rights and entitlements that a Ukrainian will enjoy are kind of harmonized across Europe. So people are less likely to move on. And that means that people have some stability, at least kind of for the time being. In terms of their legal status, things do get a bit tricky here, because under this EU approach, they get temporary protection status, which is exactly that. It's temporary. And it means living in like constant anxiety of return to the country of persecution and of having your right to remain, your right to work, access benefits withdrawn. And this may be fine for some Ukrainians who fully intend to return to Ukraine at the first opportunity. But I think, you know, with every day and with every bit of news coming out that, you know, return looks less certain, you know, it looks less likely to happen in the imminent future. So we know that ending war is only one part of the picture as well. I mean, people need a country to return to. They need jobs and homes. And, you know, many of these things have been destroyed. And we've seen the images. And of course, the remedy to this is refugee status, which should ensure some kind of durable protection and integration opportunities for those seeking safety. But, you know, refugee status comes with a lot of quite generous rights that states are often reluctant to grant, particularly on a very large scale, which I think is another one of the reasons why we've seen the approach that has been taken both in the EU and in the UK.
Following on from that, what are the key international laws?
I mean, so the key piece of international human rights law that applies to displaced Ukrainians right now is the 1951 Refugee Convention and its 1967 protocol. The convention effectively deals with the problems that arise when people can no longer rely on their state to protect their most fundamental rights. And it basically outlines what a refugee is, as well as the duties that are owed by states to those who arrive on their territory fleeing persecution. So, I mean, I guess the key question here is whether those fleeing Ukraine right now are refugees. And the thing is that being a refugee and having refugee status are two very different things. So, you know, refugee status is declaratory, which I mean that if you meet the definition of a refugee in the convention, then you are automatically a refugee, regardless of whether that status has been formally recognised. So if a Ukrainian has crossed over the border into a neighbouring country seeking protection from persecution for a convention reason, and that could be their race, their religion, their political opinion, then they are automatically a refugee and they're entitled to all the rights and benefits under international law that carries. These include things like the right to lawful residence, right to work. I mentioned some of them earlier, you know, right to study, to claim housing benefits. But here's the bite. You have to be formally recognised as a refugee in order to benefit from most of the convention's provisions. And to do this, you have to apply for asylum. But there is one really, really key protection, one key right that the Refugee Convention guarantees to all refugees, regardless of whether their status has been recognised, and that's the right of non-refoulement. And this right protects refugees from being returned to the country of persecution, and it obliges states to give refugees access to their territory in order to examine their claim for protection. And what this means in practice is that kind of any signatory to the convention, including the UK, can't deny Ukrainians access to the asylum procedure or do anything that risks them being sent back either directly or indirectly to persecution in Ukraine. But what they can do is make it really hard to get to UK territory.
I think it's so fascinating. It's almost like a sleight of hand that I feel is happening at the moment in the way we talk about the Ukrainians. So, I mean, they're actually being described as guests by the government, which I find mind-blowing, because I mean, it is that special treatment. But also the same with Afghans, we were told you need to refer to them as evacuees, not refugees. And so there's all this terminology which I think is, you know, obviously a result of this Nationality and Borders Bill that's coming in, and they want to be able to distinguish. But effectively it's a nonsense, isn't it, because they should be afforded the same protections. They should all just be classed as refugees.
Yeah, I mean, this government is going out of its way to not describe Ukrainians as refugees and to not grant them refugee status. And there's a few reasons for that. I mean, part of it goes back to kind of my earlier points around the absolute terror of overloading the UK's asylum system. And I think the recognition that we have asylum system that is not in any way capable of processing, you know, even the number of claims that are going through it at the moment. We've got phenomenal waiting lists. We also don't have the infrastructure in our kind of refugee housing and reception to absorb the kind of numbers. So they are terrified of kind of giving them. I mean, there's a political dimension to it as well. But yeah, I mean, what we've seen as a result is that you know, Ukrainians are basically being treated as migrants. You know, they are visa nationals for UK immigration law, so they do need a visa to come to the UK. And you know, we know that you can't apply for an asylum visa, that you can't apply for asylum to the UK from outside the UK. So, you know, as a Ukrainian seeking protection, you really only have kind of the two options that the UK government is mandating, and that's the Ukraine family scheme, which is a visa-based scheme, so that, you know, British people and some but not all immigrants can bring, you know, family members, quite a wide range of family members, to the UK. I think there have been about 23,000 family visas that have been issued. And then there's the Homes for Ukraine scheme. Again, it's a visa scheme. And, you know, you've mentioned, you've talked a bit about how it works with, you know, a sponsor in the UK can host a Ukrainian in their home. And all the kind of, you know, they get 3 years leave to remain, as they do under the Ukraine family scheme. But, you know, these are, both of these schemes are visa-based immigration schemes to respond to what is in actual fact a refugee displacement situation.
I think what's interesting, and we're finding in the Northwest as well, is a lot of people have crossed the Irish border, obviously, because they can get into Dublin without a visa, have walked across, and then are getting the ferries across to Liverpool and Heysham. And they're being told to present at the councils as homeless without applying for asylum. And obviously we're like, well, under what status? What is going on? But there's unconfirmed reports that's been the advice from Border Force. Like you say, they're doing absolutely everything not to put them in the asylum system.
Yeah, and it, you know, people will make their own way. They will. If they want to get to the UK and for whatever reason they don't, you know, they don't meet the requirements of one of the two schemes, let's say they've fled Ukraine without any documentation. I mean, imagine you're running for your life and you don't think to pick up your birth certificate, your mortgage documents, your the proof that you're not a war criminal. That is one of the questions that they get asked. And you know, you come with, you have nothing. You have the clothes on your back and the children in your arms. And so you can't prove who you are for the 51-page application process, or maybe your family members in the UK aren't eligible to sponsor you or can't host you, or, you know, for one of the many reasons, you just can't wait to go through what is, you know, proving to be a really lengthy process. Then you're going to make your own way. But if you're going to do this, you better do it before the Borders Bill passes later this month. Because, you know, if Rebecca, you've really talked about how people are being misinformed and treated and excluded, you know, from the help they need when they arrive now. But, you know, if people come after the bill passes, and this includes Ukrainians, they are very likely to be criminalized on arrival, if they turn up without a visa, they'll be denied access to the UK asylum system while the UK seeks to return them to whichever safe country or country with whom they think they have a connection. They might be sent offshore, possibly to Rwanda for processing. They might be, if they do remain in the UK, they'll be left languishing in some detention centre while the Home Office tries to send them away. If they manage to get refugee status, they will be treated as a second-class refugee with no access or limited access to welfare benefits, no right to bring their family members over and limited leave to remain. This is what this government is going to do to refugees under this bill. I think if most people realised that that is going to be the situation for Ukrainians after the passage of this bill, then they would be horrified.
Putting that, sounds flippant, to one side, what source of support and guidance is there in place at the moment for people coming to the UK from Ukraine or from elsewhere? Like, is there some sort of, you know, like you said, people leave without their key documents. What can they be doing? Is there any guidance already in place for them?
I mean, it's frightening. I can only imagine what it's like, you know, trying to work out what your options are when you are trying to, you know, trying to find out the latest information on what you might be entitled to within an EU member state and how that compares to what you might be entitled to if you make it to the UK, what the eligibility requirements are for, you know, satisfying the demands of the two visa schemes and sort of comparing and contrasting and what that might mean in the longer term as well for your status, for your, you know, for the potential for extending your status, for bringing your family members over. I mean, these are the kind of things that people are going to be, you know, worried about. Where are they going to live? Where are their kids going to go to school? How are you going to find all of that information out?
Yeah, but also for the people that are hosting, you know, who lots of people, as we said, 200,000 people already signed up to help. Is there information for them to be passing on to the people they're going to be, I hesitate to use the word, but hosting, you know, where can people find this sort of information and support as to know what they can do to make everything a bit better when they do arrive?
In terms of kind of making the decision sort of out in the region of origin, I would say the first thing I think I would caution probably about taking any kind of immigration advice from anyone who's other than a qualified and regulated immigration lawyer, which is going to be a challenge in you know, a UK immigration lawyer, finding one of those when you're in Moldova. But there has been a project set up. A group of volunteer legal professionals in the UK have set up a service connecting people fleeing Ukraine, so still in region, with free legal advice on UK immigration and visas and asylum. And you can find out more about this. They've got a website. I think it's advice-ukraine.co.uk. So they, you know, that is a service that you could seek. But, you know, I think if you're in the UK and you want to find out more, you want to find out more particularly about the kind of Homes for Ukraine scheme, you can go onto the gov.uk or RESET websites and you can sign up. You can find out more and sign up there. If you're interested more generally in kind of welcoming refugees, then, you know, that there are other projects as well. There's the Refugees at Home, which is a charity that connects refugees and asylum seekers who are in the UK now with people who have space to accommodate them in their home. So there are kind of a range of sort of sources of information within the UK about hosting Ukrainians and hosting others more generally. I think if you're motivated and inspired to do more to support refugees in the UK, then you can kind of support organisations like Freedom From Torture that provide specialist support and campaign for refugee rights. You can do some activism of your own. You can write to your MP and let them know that you want the UK to be a welcoming and compassionate country for refugees, no matter where they're from or how they got here. So there are lots of things you can do if you are interested and you want to do something.
I would add to that in terms of resources for sponsors. City of Sanctuary UK website is fantastic, and they've put up a things to consider checklist about, you know, the financial reality, the emotional reality of hosting somebody who's fled a war with trauma and all the things that comes with. NACOM as well, the No Accommodation Network, are doing some training, and there's some resources online which are very useful for sponsors. I would also recommend people get in touch with their local councils, because I do know that councils are trying their very, very best to provide webinars and training and free resources to people. And I think a bit of patience is required with that, because some councils will never have met a refugee in their life and some will be very, very experienced in it, but everyone's certainly trying. So it's worth getting in contact locally. But yeah, City of Sanctuary and NACOM would be a very good call for people who haven't yet made the decision.
That's extremely helpful. And Rebecca, so I guess that segues quite nicely into really hearing a bit more about what you're doing day to day and the mechanisms of making these quite ambitious government promises a reality. And from what you've described, it sounds like it's extremely uncertain and that the government's not being completely sort of clear on how they want this cohort of people to be treated and what's going to be available to them. So it would be really interesting to hear what's happening in Lancashire.
Yeah, I mean, speaking candidly, like I said, there's a lot of firefighting. And yeah, as I said, there's a lot of government guidance yet to be finalised, and yet the visas are still being processed and Ukrainian people are already arriving. So there's really no time for local authorities to kind of sit down and plan and strategise and recruit and resource as we would wish to. It's happening. And I think that's quite a difficult place for a lot of local authorities, because they're not used to being in the midst of a humanitarian crisis. Before COVID, it wasn't kind of your common day to day. But fortunately, a lot of the councils now have dedicated resettlement teams with people who do have experience of working in refugee camps and more disaster management skills. So it's that day to day of kind of making sure you're planning and resourcing while simultaneously responding, making sure it's happening. So we've been putting in systems and protocols based on our best practice from other resettlement schemes. The first thing is getting districts to do property checks. So going out and making sure that the offers of a house are real, that the house is there, that the bedroom is there, that the house is safe. Suitability assessments, because obviously there's a vulnerability for the sponsors as well. We don't know. You know, we have had a few people who've been victims of fraud, who might have learning disabilities, etc., who just are really going to struggle with a kind of experience like this. So we have to safeguard the sponsors as well as the guests. We're then doing training, providing ongoing support, translating resources, preparing local groups. We're with our local partners such as DWP, NHS and CCGs, making sure there's kind of like a dedicated officer in that team who knows what's coming this way. I think it's worth noting that the NHS and CCGs aren't getting any funding through this scheme, which is quite unusual. So for other resettlement schemes, there would be health funding. And given the levels of trauma and mental health needs we've seen with other cohorts, I don't see why this would be any different for the Ukrainians. So that is a concern. But yeah, it's at the moment, the biggest challenge for us is kind of identifying when people are coming, because there's no link up with Border Force. So we're fully reliant on sponsors to tell us when somebody's arrived, which I'm sure we'll come to later, but it's just a safeguarding disaster, frankly. So a lot of the work at the moment is chasing people to say, is somebody here? Is it the people we think you said were going to be here? Because obviously a lot of people have filled in the visa application incorrectly, because it's a very arduous and complicated form. And they might have put, oh, we're taking one person, and we turn up at the house and there's four people there and three of them are under 18. So it's just taking an absolute mammoth amount of resources, and a lot of it's business support. I know it sounds so silly, but pupil access, for example, having to process 400 in-year school applications within a week is mammoth. And then again for public health, and again for, and it's going on and on. So firefighting is the best description of what we're doing.
Wow, that sounds, I mean, I think so many people have signed up to the Home to Ukraine scheme, and it's just this idea that you offer someone a home and that's sort of the end of the story. But of course, as you say, it impacts on every aspect of all local authority services, the NHS, and if there's no resource and funding, that puts a huge strain. And I think that's the idea that you raised there about this gap, this between people arriving and you not knowing about that. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that, because we've got a question here about key risks and challenges, and that sounds like like something that is a key risk?
Yeah, I mean, the list of risks is quite long, but if we stick to the key ones, so the one that's coming up for me the most is the fact that there's no clear agreement on unaccompanied children being sponsored. So it's not actually written on the guidance that they have to be over 18. We've asked for clarity from the Department of Levelling Up and Housing and Communities. And they've told us, yeah, they must be over 18. If they're not over 18, they have to have an adult with them. However, that contradicts the information that's been given by UK Visas and Immigration, who've told our sponsors that if they have a letter of parental consent, that's enough to get people here. And we've heard that over and over again. So there are numerous people expecting lone children to come over, and they will be their sponsor for them. And obviously a lot of people don't understand how dark the world can be, and why we would be concerned about that. And they do have genuinely good intentions, but without the clear guidance and the UKVI saying different things, that's a bit of a disaster for us. Similarly, we don't get any information or confirmation about arrivals. So effectively, hundreds of people could go missing. We're wholly reliant on the sponsor to inform us if a guest has arrived. So if somebody has ill intent, they could fill in the visa, bring the sponsor over and deny that that individual ever entered the UK. They could just say, oh, they decided not to fly after they got the visa and stayed wherever. And we simply wouldn't know. And even if the visa status was approved, they could just simply state, no, they decided not to fly. So it's not enough for us to say, OK, we can see that the visa application was approved and we can knock on your door. We need border force to say, yes, they arrived in the country.
So Rebecca, I'm butting in there, but I know after the, you know, the Syrian crisis in 2015, I think it was 10,000 at least children disappeared. Just, you know, no trace, no records kept. I mean, the numbers are going to be much higher this time, aren't they? And it's checks much fewer, you know, far fewer checks going on, and visa-free movement going on. I mean, it's a very frightening prospect of having tens of thousands of young people / children disappearing from any form of, well, formal arrangement.
It's genuinely haunting. Like, no exaggeration to say most of us haven't slept since this scheme launched. And when they launched it, there was this almost disbelief, like this can't be accurate. And I know so many NGOs have written and said, look, this is a well-oiled human trafficking machine that you've set up here. And still, you know, still no changes have been made. And I just don't see how we can even safeguard them when we're here, because we're not being asked to do casework the same as we would do with the Syrian scheme or Afghans. So there isn't that same level of support. And in places for us like East Lancashire, there are no school places. So one of the biggest kind of safeguarding factors for a child is being in school and having teachers have their eyes on you every day. Many of our Ukrainian children will not be in school in East Lancashire for months. We simply cannot build a school overnight. And our out of school English provision is already full. So that will be commissioned. But again, it doesn't happen overnight with no planning and absolutely no indication of numbers. It's almost impossible to plan. So yeah, it's terrifying. And we also have, you know, the ports where we are, and we know that any human traffickers worth their salt will be seeing Heysham and Liverpool as a fantastic opportunity to just bring people across there visa free. Nobody's doing any check. Yeah, speechless isn't the word, because I've got lots to say about it, but I just cannot believe at any point that they have consulted human trafficking or modern slavery experts when designing this scheme. It doesn't add up.
I mean, on the contrary, I suspect that human trafficking and modern slavery organizations have been expressing their concerns about this at great extent. It is terrifying. It is really terrifying. And I think this is what you get when you have a government that is, you know, for well or other, you know, intentions, seeking to respond urgently to an outpouring of public concern, but without the kind of, you know, without the kind of policy thinking and, you know, practical and resource, you know, thinking having gone in behind it. You know, it's very much a kind of immediate, almost knee-jerk policymaking, and it's really scary. And you know, these are people, not packages. You can't stick them on a plane like a DHL and send them off into the unknown without kind of thinking very, very carefully about whether it's the right thing for them, whether, you know, whether it's the best thing to meet their needs, and whether where you're sending them is capable of meeting those needs, of safeguarding them and of protecting them. It feels like an incredibly irresponsible way of responding to an urgent humanitarian situation.
I was just going to say, this is the thing, like even in a well-intentioned match, you're going to have problems because of a power imbalance, etc. But what we were told quite clearly from the start is, even if we do the property checks, the social care checks, the suitability checks, if we found that they're not suitable, that doesn't veto the visa. So people are still coming, they're still arriving. There's absolutely no link up between the visa process and our checks. And we've already done a social care trawl and found, oh, actually there are Schedule 1 offenders living in that household who don't declare to live there, but we know they live there because of social care. We have that local knowledge. And it's almost like, why are we doing this? Obviously, morally, we're doing these checks, but why are we feeding back these checks to the government if it's not going to veto anything or make a difference? Then they arrive here and we immediately have to find them homelessness provision, which just isn't out there. So incredibly vulnerable people coming here, becoming homeless, and again, their vulnerability escalates even more.
For the people who are coming and get matched with, well, for want of a better word, you know, families who are genuine, and I think there's lots and lots out there. Even in my small world in London, I have lots of friends who have signed up and lots of welcoming families who are excited about helping people. What should they be doing in order to safeguard the families that they're putting up? I mean, Sophia and I work with, you know, lots of schools, and we would always point people towards the safeguarding leads in schools as experts on how to, as you said, you know, school is a very important part of young people's lives, and it's a great way of ensuring that people are kept safe. What more can host families be doing, though, to look out for the safety or make sure that the families coming to them are as well supported and looked after as they can be?
I think definitely linking in with your local authority and getting access to all their resources and all their support. So you're kind of linked in with a formal group to protect yourself. I think a big, big part of this will be making sure that your guests have a network. So a lot of the reports of abuse and modern slavery will come to us from Ukrainian guests telling us about other Ukrainian guests who they're concerned about. So they need to be making those friendship groups and looking after each other. Like you say, getting the children into education as early as possible, making sure they're registered with a GP. The more social bonds they have and social links, the safer they are. That's the thing, though, the people who kind of make themselves known to us are not the ones we're concerned about. So it's very much making sure they know how to report concerns about modern slavery. So I know on our Facebook group, we put to sponsors, these are the numbers you call. Even if you think you're being dramatic, just call it, let somebody else decide. This is the number you call for this. So being the kind of eyes and ears for all these things, and being aware that the risk of modern slavery and exploitation does grow infinitely in war, and it is a reality. I think something for sponsors to get their head around is, it's very common. Modern slavery is very common. There's hundreds of thousands of people living in that situation in the UK now. So don't think you're being dramatic or paranoid. We would rather know about it.
It's hard to know kind of what the level of kind of trauma we're going to be seeing for those kind of coming through this scheme. I think I mentioned earlier, I suspect that kind of the most traumatized people probably won't be accessing these visa schemes for a multitude of reasons, and in some ways that actually might, you know, I'm kind of think that might be for the best. I'm not sure that someone with trauma is someone with severe trauma and complex needs is suitable to be housed in a spare room in a private house. I mean, that's my sense. They need space, they need safety, they need stability, and they need specialist support. And you know, those that do make it to the UK are going to need the support of local authority social care teams. So, you know, they need to be properly resourced to deliver this. They need to be able to plan their resources to be able to respond to those levels of complex needs. And I'm listening to Rebecca, just, you know, it fills me with anxiety about, you know, what our local authorities are going to be facing, you know, over the next year or so in order to pick up the pieces of you know, what does look to be quite a poorly thought through response.
I think that's quite a crucial point, isn't it, about also sponsors safeguarding themselves. And it can't be hammered home enough that living with somebody with trauma or PTSD causes vicarious trauma for many people. My husband's a refugee and I love him very, very much, but when his PTSD is bad and when it's triggered, it's a really unpleasant environment. And I think if you're with a stranger who is going through that, sometimes it can border on abusive, and people need to feel confident that they can report or tell someone, I need help, and don't think, oh, I'm not being a good Samaritan if I say I can't cope with this, because it's too much. And I don't think the mental health resources are there to protect people. So yeah, we know that when people are in that period of stability, that's almost when the PTSD gets worse, because your brain has a moment to breathe and unravel and process it. And then the behaviour becomes really, really difficult. And it's sad because it is a passing phase and it is a trigger, but it's very real and can be very abusive nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly our experience of working with torture survivors and others with diagnosed PTSD and depression and anxiety, that it is that moment at which kind of your immediate safety needs are met, and perhaps you have a period of stability that, you know, that things begin to surface. So, you know, I think, you know, you're right. And I think we will then, you know, we will at some point start seeing people coming through to our services, I expect. I hope so. I hope they get referred through to our services. And the other thing to bear in mind is around their legal status. So again, while not immediately pressing, they'll have 3 years leave when they arrive through this scheme, but it will be something that they need to get advice and support to resolve, because it's not at all clear right now what's going to happen at the end of that period of leave to those who've come through these schemes, what, you know, what options are going to be offered to them to extend their leave. And, you know, it's all going to be in the gift of the UK government to determine whether they could and should return to Ukraine at that point. And, you know, that creates a huge amount of uncertainty and anxiety for people. So they're going to need to know what their rights are when they get here. And they're going to need to start early sorting out their legal status, because we all know how long it takes the Home Office to process any kind of immigration or asylum claim.
I think we started on such a sort of positive note, talking so much around the open-heartedness shown by the British people. And I think as we've sort of dug down into the mechanisms and the realities of the situation, we've got such a long list of really worrying challenges and things that need thinking through. And I suppose it's, where do we find that balance to ensure that we don't, I suppose, discourage people from reaching out and wanting to support people who are coming in to the UK, but making sure that they do so with a sort of informed point of view and, you know, with knowledge and sort of cognizance of the risks. And I know we've already touched on it, because we've spoken about the resources that can be found in local authorities, and that things will be put in place as this process develops and as the situation evolves. But I suppose it's not really a question, it's more just a comment, but it's about how do we find that balance between ensuring people feel confident to stay engaged in this and offer their homes, while being aware of how to safeguard their guests and themselves.
I think it's worth as well noting that there's so many other ways to help refugees as well. And this is a beautiful thing that people are doing, opening their homes. There's no doubt about that. But there are tens of thousands of other people in need. And I think if you can link in with your refugee and asylum drop-ins, they're always looking for ESOL volunteers, people who can help with English, people who can help with befriending, just simple tasks. And this is further, I mean, there was already kind of like a first class, second class distinction in refugee resettlement through people who came through the resettlement schemes and asylum seekers. And now this has created like a business class, you know, this is the Ukrainians get treated one way. And you know, the complaints about waiting 2 weeks for a visa, well, many asylum seekers wait three years for a decision. So there are people desperately in need who are arriving off the boats now with nothing but the clothes they stand in, and they don't get a package of support. So there's so many opportunities out there to do wonderful things and really transform people's lives. And it doesn't, you don't have to open your home. You know, there's, go and volunteer, go and befriend people, go to the food drop-ins. It's all as meaningful.
Yeah, and Rebecca's supporting lots of local charities, of which certainly where I live in West London, there's lots of people, like you say, wanting to help and actually setting up really good organisations and or working with organisations in order to provide that support. You know, sports camps in during the Easter holidays and cooking classes and things to get people out and trying to give them some sort of normality as well, and not to be made to feel very aware all the time of their extraordinary position at the moment. I'd really like to thank you both so much for A, giving up your time today to have this great conversation with us, B, for doing an amazing job. I think it lots of our listeners will be overwhelmed by the work that you're both doing and the, you know, effort and intelligence and awareness which you have and you're using your expertise to help people at this terrible time. So thank you so much for sharing your experience and your thoughts and your ideas and where you think this might end up. It's really, we're really very grateful to you for doing this. And as Sophia said, it's quite depressing. It's a situation that can leave us all feeling fairly useless. So I hope people have enjoyed as much as you can enjoy this issue, but listening to some ideas that can be shared and to give people confidence to find out more about the situation.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you both.
Thanks very much to everyone for listening.